One of the favorite things that I think we get to do is we get to hear from some of our listeners.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So Chris from Tennessee, he said this, I listen every day. And I'm so glad that you have the app, because if I miss a day, I can go back and listen to it. And oftentimes I go back and listen to programs from before because they're worth repeating.
And here's the great thing. There are millions of Chris's and Christine's out there listening to the Family Life broadcast, the podcast. They're going to our Weekend to Remember Marriage conferences. They're buying our resources. I mean, God is changing the world one home at a time, and Family Life is a big part of that. And here's the thing. We want to invite you to help us change the world.
Yeah, we have a goal of raising $250,000.
This month, in the month of August.
Yes.
I mean, that's a big goal. But I tell you what, you can be a part of joining us and being a partner with us. You can give at any level you'd like. And you can do that. Just go to familylifetoday.com and you can make a donation.
And if you give, we're going to send you one of our favorite books by one of our favorite authors,
Grant Hanson. Oh, yeah, he's the
best. It's called Unoffendable.
Yeah, you're never offended, neither am I. But no, it helps us to live an undefendable life. And we're going to send you a limited edition Family Life pen. So you can take notes of Brant's book.
It's just
another way to remember you're making a mark and we're making a mark together. So go to familylifetoday.com and make a mark right now.
We need you.
You cannot just want the God of the law, because if that's all you have, then you will become a punishing person, right? A person who wants justice at all costs and has no love. And then, of course, if you only want the God who listens, then absolutely you want love, but you want it without standard. You want it without expectation, and you want it without obligation. And you have to have both.
Welcome to Family Life Today, where we want to help you pursue the relationships that matter most. I'm Shelby Abbott, and your hosts are Dave and Ann Wilson. You can find us at familylifetoday.com or on the Family Life app.
This is Family Life Today.
All right, so we are back for part two, and it may be part two of 12. I don't know. This story with Daniel Nary. Daniel, say your last name, because we've been talking about this off air.
Yeah, Nayeri.
So we're talking about your book, Everything Sad is Untrue, which is really your story. And yesterday you ended with basically you sleep under the bed because you're so scared.
As a little boy.
That's right.
Wait, recap for us, Daniel.
Yeah. In 38 seconds. Recap the whole
last time on FLR. Where were we? Well, we were born and raised in Iran. My mother, a devout Muslim, converts to Christianity as a matter of faith and conscience. It's a capital crime. And so she's caught by the secret police, interrogated, and told that if they don't tell the names of all the people in the underground church, they'll kill her and her kids. So jump forward to a quick escape from Iran, where my father chooses to stay, and my mother, my sister, and I become refugees. And I think we pick it up there. We land from a plane into the UAE, where at that point we become what is known as the global homeless, right? Anytime, the difference between a refugee and an immigrant, of course, is that their state of citizenship or their country of citizenship is trying to do them but harm. And so this happens in instances of genocide, civil war, revolution, these kinds of things. At that point, all our documents are, you know, moot. We don't have citizenship. I don't think we even packed. I know we didn't pack my birth certificate. So quite a lot of complexity gets put into the system. But effectively, we are missing from our court date in Iran and now wandering in the UAE.
And you are how old and your sister?
I'm 5. She's 8.
And you're coming from an affluent family. Or your dad was a dentist, your mom's a doctor, and now you have nothing.
Yeah, that was quite a threshold, right? There was, in Iran, there was quite a lot of land, and my mother had her own practice. My father had his own practice. We had a lovely home in Isfahan in a nice area, and you know, all the families around. So there's all that kind of institutional, generational wealth of just like grandpa has a house and you can go there on the weekends, and it's on a beautiful orchard because he, you know, he tills and works the land. And so, yeah, it was, I would call it a very, certainly by comparison, an incredibly affluent life. The minute we sort of become refugees, it sort of goes away. And there was actually a missionary couple from Australia, and they were doctors as well. And they had a clinic in Abu Dhabi. You know, we were able to sort of live in the back of that clinic, and my mother worked there for about 10 months while we were trying to figure out how to get asylum. When you're a refugee, one of the tasks is that you're going to the embassies of these different countries. If you need protection from, like, Iranian government, what you're looking for is all, you're looking for asylum, you're looking for protection. So you're kind of, your choices are, you know, the UK, Canada, America, Australia, the West. And so you're going to these embassies and you're effectively speaking to these, you know, administrators and trying to convince them of a lot of things, because it's a dark place, right? It's a dark world. So one of the first things you have to establish is, are these actually your kids, right? There's a lot of trafficking in them. So if we don't have the documentation, if you don't have, I mean, frankly, you know, if you don't even speak, you know, there's a lot of challenge in just saying, okay, we need to have a translator. We need to fill out all the papers.
We don't have your birth certificate.
Right. Exactly. We have to sit in, and then they're in Farsi, right? So, so you're kind of in this very amorphous holding pattern, because the waiting room is chock full of people. There's babies everywhere. There's people everywhere. There's crying. It's a very chaotic environment. Think of, like, the worst DMV you've ever been to. And
there's a lot of
terrible.
And then, take a number. A
lot of papers, and in language you don't speak. A lot of people trying to hawk their translation services. Some of them from well-meaning NGOs. That's great. Some of them maybe there to make a buck. So you're kind of trying to suss this out. You're trying to figure out what's going on. You're waiting for your turn. You get your number. You have a person who is an unsmiling individual who's there to ask a lot of questions, and frankly, there to filter a lot of, you know, what we could just euphemistically call shenanigans, right? A lot of people trying to get places, a lot of people lying about their refugee status, a lot of people who, you know, are just trying to get to the West and they're not in any kind of danger. So you have to establish the fact that you are in physical harm. There's actual danger for you. You have to establish that, again, these are your kids. They're going to interview the kids. Yikes. And so it's just a very pressurized environment. And then that's just for one country. You're interviewing, you know, you're applying for other lots of countries. So there's just, it's a time that a lot of people describe as a lot of waiting, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of trying to tell your story to somebody who is, you know, it's not necessarily their fault, right? They're at that point immune to the pain of other people. Like they sit there and
every day
there's liars and there's thieves, but there's also tragic, horrible circumstances, and there's, you know, people who are in extreme duress and none of it can be communicated. The language barrier is very real.
Have you ever asked your mom at that time, like, what was going on for her spiritually? I'm imagining myself with two little kids, like, I'm praying, I'm crying, like, God, I need you so desperately.
Yeah.
Did she ever talk about that?
She does, yeah. The strain was quite heavy at that point. I remember days where she's just so stressed and crying and breaking down on the back of a bus or something like that. And, you know, those days are there too. But on the whole, kind of this feeling of provision.
She felt God's hand.
Yeah. I mean, there were just so many instances of something wild happening, some very improbable. For example, you know, we hear that the Iranian government is still kind of, they're searching for us. That it was a black eye to kind of lose this person who had committed apostasy, and we hear this and we think, oh no, you know, what could happen? And, you know, within a short period of time, we hear that we get a temporary admittance to Italy, where they had a refugee camp set up, a refugee settlement. It was an old hotel called the Hotel Barba in the outskirts of Rome. There's a feeling, a malaise culturally and spiritually that happens in these places where you're just waiting. You have a sudden, like, negative space that happens in your life. And this is what's happening for months and months, right? You don't get the feeling. You can't garden, right? Well, you can wait for the stuff to come up. You don't think to yourself, could I maximize my productivity during this time? You just think, let me just wait for this paperwork to happen and who knows where I'll be. Like, should you even study English or should you study Swedish? Like, should you study, like, I don't know, you could end up either one.
Yeah.
And so there's a real challenge there. And my mother was very aggressively trying to keep us out of that nihilistic, that's sort of just the sadness of it all.
I can't imagine.
And so she found the family again. She was sort of searching through these church organizations. She found a family that were, they were there for the husband's work, but they were homeschooling their kids. So they had these workbook, this curriculum. It was like 66 workbooks, 11 subjects, or six subjects, 11 books. And they had kids our age. And so she would, you know, we'd get on a bus every morning instead of staying in this kind of refugee holding space. We would get on a bus, go through Rome, get to their house. They were really kind about letting us have the old books that they'd used. She would buy these big erasers and she would sit next to us and just erase workbooks all day and hand them to my sister and I. And we would fill them out. And that's how I learned the beginnings of English. And it was happening.
Look at your mom go.
She's wild, right? Unstoppable.
Yeah. And look at God, like, giving her wisdom to know what to do, to where to go, who to talk to. Yeah. But he puts these pretty pivotal people in your lives.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's where I think a lot of the feeling of the answer to prayer happens in her life, because it's just in the form of somebody having kids exactly our age.
Mm.
Well, that's wild, right? I mean, it's not improbable, but it's not exactly common either.
Yeah.
And so I remember our time in Italy is kind of fascinating and beautiful. We didn't have the money to, like, sightsee, but we would go to a town like Florence and sleep on the train on the way back, but also get 6 hours there, you know? And I think it's really just that. It was the energy of her that, like, we're not gonna sit. This isn't going to be a death sentence.
Are you listening to that as women? Like, I'm thinking of the many moms that are listening. Like, we impact our kids.
Yeah.
You know, they're watching us. They feel our energy. They feel our walk with God. I think that's important to remind ourselves. Like, we're making a difference in our kids' lives.
Yeah, to this day, that kind of travel is my favorite. Like,
really?
I adore, like, backpacking and traveling in really, like, in a really kind of limited way. And I think it's from that, memory. So the story goes that, you know, during we spent another stint there until a family in Oklahoma, we hear, through several different church organizations, were willing to sponsor us. And their names were Jim and Jean Dawson. And Jim was a retired engineer from NASA, and Jean was a teacher. And they had their children, and their children were grown, and they lived in this house in Edmond and were retired. Kind of a wild thing to do. I think back on it now, and they felt that, you know, God had put it on their heart to do that. And you would have to, because it's a logistically bananas thing to do. Like, imagine you hear on paper, a single mom, doesn't speak the language, two kids under 10, they're going to come. And if they're like, if they become wards of the state, your credit is shot. It's a complete, like, to co-sign for a refugee family is a really big burden. To my mother's credit, like, she wasn't here to, you know, be still either. So we landed, and within weeks, she has her driver's license and her, you know, green card, and has got a job. And, you know, we weren't there longer than weeks, right? We had an apartment.
Could she speak English?
At that time, it would be a very difficult English.
Yeah.
It was, she could understand pretty well, but making herself understood was a lot harder.
Mm.
Pretty strong accent, not able to work. In a kind of that kind of high professional capacity. She had sort of more menial jobs at that time. The language barrier was the reason. But yeah, so we land in Oklahoma, and all of a sudden it's that kind of story of everything is different and everything is kind of new, and I'm trying to just understand it all.
Listen to this quote. It says, "The legend of my mom is that she can't be stopped. Not when you hit her, not when a whole country full of goons puts her in a cage, not even if you make her poor and try to kill her slowly in the little by little poison of sadness. And the legend is true, I think, because she's fixed her eyes on something beyond the rivers of blood to a beautiful place on the other side. How else would anybody do it?" I mean, what a tribute really to your mom.
Yeah. She's absolutely the hero of this book. You know, there's another line in there that sort of I think of as my mother's mantra, which is, you know, trying to redefine strength for people And it says, like, it's not this, like, gigantic, muscled, you know, tough guy. It's, you know, for me, it's this image of my mother, who, as I said, is this very diminutive person. And the line is, you know, if you don't stop, you're unstoppable. Mm. You know, not that if you're incapable of being stopped, but if you don't stop, you're unstoppable. And I think about that a lot when I think about her.
Mm. I mean, when you think back on your life and even now, where do you see God or Jesus in the story, besides walking in your sister's bed
in a room?
Yeah, but I mean, as you look through and think about your life, do you feel like there's a Jesus behind the curtain the whole time?
Oh, of course. I don't know if he was so removed as to be behind the curtain. I think,
good answer.
I think he was right in the middle of the whole thing. I mean, it's almost impossible. And not to, it would be very challenging for me to disassociate this, right? Because my life is utterly different. A story, no matter how sad or problematic, once it ends this way, has to have been the best path because it ended with my wife and son. So once you have a kid, the valence of almost every decision you've made changes. That journey led to here, and I'm just utterly grateful for it. So,
I mean, was there a moment where you're faith in that Jesus, like your mom's faith?
Mm-hmm.
Did that happen for you in high school or middle school or anytime?
Yeah. One thing I always say is when you have a mom like mine, you have to contend with this topic, right?
Moms, are you listening to this? This is so good for us to hear.
Well, because, I mean, everyone, I'll tell my friends and, you know, anywhere, I'll tell adults, like, we'll be sitting around, I'll tell them part of the story and I'll describe what she had, right? And all the sort of material things of the world. And then I describe what life was like for a long time for us, where we were just dirt poor. And there'll be a moment where people are kind of, you know, they're standing around, they're listening, and someone will always pause and go, so then why did she do all this?
Yeah.
And what's funny is my mom always gets this really cheeky look in her face when someone asks that question, because she'll just, the only answer is, because it's true. Like, because you have to ask yourself when you look at my mother, was she nuts? Like the worst trade in the history of trades?
Yeah.
Or did she make a good trade? And the trade was everything: family, home, country, money, wealth, practice, professional advancement, you name it. And on the other side is nothing but Jesus. And you go, well, she's either nuts or she's a logical person who made a trade that had absolutely the right value. Like, she, because no one makes a trade unless they think they're getting the better part of it.
Right.
And so she got the better part of that trade.
As you're talking about, your mom's the hero of the story, and your mom's hero is Jesus.
Right. Yeah.
Jesus is the one that did all of that. And he continues to do that for all of us. I look at you like you grow up as a young man. You're in Tim Keller's church being discipled by him for years. Of all the places to go spiritually for that depth of being discipled.
Well, I could have been in our church and been discipled by me, but yeah, Tim Keller's a good second.
I'm imagining your mom to be a woman of prayer, that she has just been on her face before God, asking her to lead, to guide, to show. And her life has been hard and yet miraculous too.
Yeah.
And you're such a reflection, all of that. Like, don't you think that with him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I haven't met her. I've seen her on video. And I love how you describe, do you want a God who listens or a God who speaks?
Right.
Explain that.
I was watching all the adults and kind of as a young person and starting to kind of think about the way they interact with God. Because like when you talk to my mother, especially during that time, like the answer to so many things was God. Like, she was like a bad Sunday school teacher where it's just like, it's like, so wait, why are we leaving my house like with Jesus? And you're like, okay, is that going to be the answer to everything? Like, could we? I was, as a kid, kind of very aware of how people interacted with their impressions of God. And so there's this line in a series in the theme in the book that where he's saying, would you rather a God who speaks or a God who listens? And he sort of describes a God who speaks is the God who comes down the mountain and gives you the law. He declares, he tells you how to be. He's the God of the Old Testament. As they say, right? He's the God who holds forth, and your job is to shut up and submit. And then there's the God who listens, who sits down beside you and lets you talk and hears your troubles and hears your sadness and understands it and takes it on. That's the God who listens. And interestingly, as he's going through the book, he's realizing that you can't be either or, right? It can't be, you cannot just want the God of the law, because if that's all you have, then you will become a punishing person, right? Mm. A person who wants justice at all costs and has no love. And then, of course, if you only want the God who listens, then absolutely you want love, but you want it without standard. You want it without expectation, and you want it without obligation. And that will also not be a proper way of mercy. To have, you know, you have to have both. They have to. You have to hold both in your hand somehow. A God who speaks and a God who listens. And you know, you look around the world and you look around different cultures, and that's pretty hard to come by. There's a lot of gods who speak and a lot of gods who listen only. Mm-hmm. And there he starts to see, as the book goes on, that Jesus is a God who speaks and a God who listens. Specifically, came down to listen, right, and at the same time to declare a very particular and important standard, right. So, going back to Tim Keller, that's pretty much like my paraphrasing of. he talks about that a lot too, right? Yeah. It cannot just be, you know, justice without mercy is cruel. You know, mm-hmm. mercy without justice is lawlessness. And so, as a young person, that would be the early seeds of, you know, me sort of trying to make that choice, you know, for myself. You know, I knew where everybody else stood.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, as I think of your mom, again, never meeting her, she revealed the God who speaks and listens
to you. Yeah.
I mean, you sort of saw it. She incarnated it in a sense. She's not God, of course, but... Yeah. I thought, you know, Jesus did that, because when you finally get to him and he says, hey, Philip, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father.
That's right.
You get both. You get the Old Testament wrapped up in grace and love. You're like, wow. Yeah. I think your mom sort of modeled that as well. It had to be so compelling. Like, who wouldn't want to follow that God that my mom is like making known through her incarnation of Jesus?
I keep having the picture of you guys coming back on a bus, imagining her packing up lunches and taking that eraser and erasing all of those workbooks.
You would do that.
So that you can do that. That's what moms do. That's what we do when we love our kids. And I just want to remind us as moms, there's never a time Jesus hasn't seen you, hasn't been wanting to talk to you, loves you, and will care for you. No matter where you are in the world, he loves you and sees you. Daniel, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That is so true. I really appreciate Anne's perspective there and reminder, Jesus sees you in all those mundane moments of life. The Savior of the world sees you, values you, and loves you more than you can imagine. It's really important to remember that when things are kind of chaotic and crazy and also just kind of boring, that the Lord sees you, he knows you, he values you, he appreciates the contributions that you make to your own family by sacrificing yourself, your time, your energy in order that your family might flourish. I'm Shelby Abbott, and you've been listening to Dave and Ann Wilson with Daniel Neyeri on Family Life Today. His story is compelling, isn't it? Well, you could read more about it and learn more about what God did from this little refugee from Iran to Oklahoma in the memoir that he wrote called Everything Sad is Untrue. You can get your copy right now by going online to familylifetoday.com, or you can find a link in the show notes. Or feel free to give us a call at 800-358-6329 to request your copy. Again, that number is 800 F as in family, L as in life, and then the word today. You know, stories like these come to us because of the partnership of people just like you who donate and make the ministry of Family Life Today possible. And all this month, we are looking to raise an additional $250,000 in new funds by the end of August. And we'd love it if you would hop in with us and become a part of the solution here at Family Life. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go online to familylifetoday.com to make your donation, or give us a call at 800-358-6329. You could also drop a donation in the mail if you'd like. Our address is Family Life, 100 Lakehart Drive, Orlando, Florida, 32832. Now, coming up tomorrow, Daniel Neri is back to talk about his journey to fatherhood, the challenges of raising a child, and the influence of Tim Keller in his life. That's coming up tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. On behalf of David Ann Wilson, I'm Shelby Abbott. We'll see you back next time for another edition of Family Life Today. Family Life Today is a donor-supported production of Family Life, a crew ministry, helping you pursue the relationships that matter most.